remember once I sat down with my boss, like, how do you edit a book? And she was like, great question. Nobody really teaches you, but people ask me a question all the time, which is, how did being an editor help you to write a book? And I was like, actually, it kind of hindered me at first.
Oh, really?
Because
Ore Agbaja-Williams is an editor and publisher of the book, The Three of Us. In today's episode, we talk about her career in publishing.
Generally in publishing, and I'm sure it's the same in any job role, to be honest, they always say that you need to be working at the next level in order to get the next job up. And that is doubly or triply true of publishing.
Wow. We talk about what it takes to write a book.
But it took actually a really long time for me to find a story that was authentic and that I really enjoyed writing, because
we talk about the money you can earn in the publishing industry and as an author.
Most authors do not make back, don't start earning royalties, and do not essentially earn out their advance, because the idea is that you, yeah, it's really hard to earn out your advance. It's really, really difficult.
Okay, wait, let's just talk about this.
And so much more. Guys, this is such an insightful conversation. Now enjoy the show.
Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does, where we talk to best friends in the hope of inspiring you to take immediate action. Today, I'm talking to my best friend, the author, Ore. How you doing?
I'm good, I'm glad to be here, thanks for having me.
My absolute pleasure, welcome to the show. We like to start with a little icebreaker. Mm-hmm. What did you want to be growing up?
Ooh, that's a great question. I don't think I really knew. I think I watched my parents become lawyers and I saw that they had to do a lot of reading, and at that time, I was not into reading. Big into reading now.
I just
into reading.
I just introed you as an author, but yeah. You weren't into reading.
No, I really wasn't.
Make it make sense.
They had to drag my sister and I to the library. But they did this thing where, like, you have to read a book and then you have to tell me what it was about. But I was like, you didn't read the book, so how are you going to know what it was about if I don't tell you? But they were very trusting, which was unwise. But they obviously knew there was a plan coming, things were going to work out. But I think I didn't really know until I got to university. And I went to a talk and I was walking around universities, and the English professor, because I went around to look at English, and he was talking about all the different careers you could do with an English degree. And he was basically going alphabetically. And at one point he says, he gets to P and he talks about publishing. And I was like, oh, what's publishing? And he starts explaining what it is and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, that sounds interesting. And so I was like, maybe I want to do that. And so that's what I ended up pursuing. I had been writing stories since I was, like, young, but it wasn't anything super serious. I think I started off telling stories for my sister and I. My older sister and I, we had doors open.
We need to take it back. Wait, because you didn't know what you wanted to be.
No.
You knew that you hated reading.
Yeah.
But you were writing stories. Yeah. You went to study English at university.
Yeah.
I think you know, low key, you kind of knew, but you didn't want to admit it to yourself.
My subconscious was saying things, and I was ignoring them.
Do you know what? As you spoke about your parents, like, not actually reading, I'm like, it's a good job it was back in the day, because now with ChatGPT and that, all it takes is a quick
go online,
summarize,
like, name the character, and be like, Sophie. The character's name is Samuel.
Yeah,
and I'd be like, it's what? True.
Wow. Yeah. So yeah. So let's take it back. So yeah, like, growing up, you're in school, like, you know that you want, so you knew you wanted to do English at university.
Well, I did skip a step. There was a point at which I liked English and I was good at English. It seemed to be my best subject, but I was actually really interested in business and economics.
Okay.
And government and politics. Mm. Unfortunately, those also, in addition to English, require a lot of writing. It was actually really sweet. When I was doing my A-levels, my mum, I did chores around the house, obviously. My mum told me, don't worry about doing chores because all your subjects are really essay heavy, which was really sweet. And I was scrolling in the net. I wasn't doing any revision or writing essays. She knows that now, I'm sure. But she was very trusting and she really was really about my education.
I love that.
But yeah, I really liked it. And actually, the first university I went to go and visit was Royal Holloway to study international relations, because I was really interested in that. Thank God I didn't go into it, because I would have been busy up to my eyeballs with all the nonsense that goes on in this world nowadays. But I think after my A-levels, I realised that I was not great at it, like, exam-wise at least. And so I was like, why don't you just pivot to the thing you know you're good at? And I think actually when I was doing the second year of my A-levels, I had two teachers who were really, really good in English and who really fostered my love of English. And I think we got to a point where we were allowed to pick which books you wanted to read. And I remember at one point I studied a poem by Maya Angelou. And I read a Chimamanda novel, and I just think having that autonomy allowed me to slowly start getting back into it. And so by the time I got to university, I was able to pick modules that I liked. I really was fascinated with reading again and started to really, really get back into it.
Okay. I love it. Yeah. So you go through university, and a question I always love to ask guests, what was your experience like? And to those who were, you know, considering going to university right now and are looking to maybe do English as a degree, is it worth the price of admission with like the rising with the rising fees?
Okay, let me start by saying, A, because I believe this, but also because I have friends who are teachers. Teachers deserve to get paid really, really, really well. They are amazing people.
Say that in there, yeah.
Teachers are amazing people. They deserve to get paid really well. They deserve respect. They put up with a lot. And they really care about what they do. So I really, really respect them. I don't think I deserve to pay £9,000 a year. I want to go back to the days when our politicians would get in university for free. That's what I want to go back to. Although in some ways, I also don't want to go back to that time because it wasn't great for people who look like you and me. But at least in the educational sense, I want to go back there. And I think, do you know what? I think I actually had a good experience at university in terms of learning different things, not necessarily perfecting them. Although university isn't about perfecting things. It is about learning different things. But
Would you go back now knowing everything you know? If you had the chance to do it all again, would you still go to university?
Yes, but not necessarily for the education.
I 100% know
for
what you
the
mean.
Experience. I was living on my own for the first time, and so were a lot of people I lived with and I knew. And it became very apparent that we'd all lived very different lives because some people lived in a way that was not known to me. And so it was about getting to know people and learning to manage differences of opinion and that kind of thing. And I think, for learning to live on your own and really having to grow up, that was a big difference. Thankfully, my parents prepared me. This is how you cook, this is how you clean, all that kind of thing. So I'd go back for the living experience and the sort of forcing yourself to grow up.
Yeah. Which is a big part.
Yeah, huge part.
Because you need
part.
To learn to just do life.
Yeah.
You don't just work.
Exactly.
So like,
that's I now know fair. How to negotiate with companies about Wi-Fi and broadband because of my experience at university being in charge of the Wi-Fi and broadband. I was in charge of all the bills, actually. I don't even know how that happened. I think I just realised nobody else was doing it. And I was like, okay, well, somebody needs to do this.
Wait, so what do I need to do to get the best Wi-Fi deal?
Oh, you just need to suffer through really bad Wi-Fi for a long time. And then you realise, this is not what life should be like.
Okay.
My Wi-Fi should be able to get upstairs, into my room, round the corner. But that is also, again, no disrespect to the people who I was taught by, because they were great. And I did some really interesting modules. But they also helped me to figure out what I didn't like. I think one of my favourite modules was Images of Africa, which was taught by a doctor called Dr. Ranka Primarek, and she was amazing. And she introduced me to, I think, literature that, bless my parents, they had actually tried to introduce me to, but I was not having it at the time.
Yeah.
So they've had a copy of Things Fall Apart on their shelves for years, Chimamanda novels on their shelves for years. I just never looked at them. And then she was like, and this person, Things Fall Apart. And then I was like, wow, this is all new to me. And my mum was like, are you joking? Like, we've had this for ages and you've just never looked at them. So I found that really fascinating. And there were things that I didn't really understand, but Dr. Primarek introduced me to one of my favourite novelists ever, Teju Cole, who's a Nigerian writer whose books are amazing. And my favourite novel ever is by him called Every Day is for the Thief. So if nobody's read that, you should read that book.
We'll link it.
Yeah, it's fantastic and it's so fun. It's got one of the most hilarious, most Nigerian insults in I've ever heard in my life. I won't spoil it, but it's fantastic.
For somebody who didn't like reading, I'm just seeing the passion ooze through here. But yeah, like going back to university and like as you come to the end of your degree, you mentioned the fact that publishing was something that was, you know, put out to you. When do you start thinking about post-university and like what that leads to? Do you do like any internships or anything like that?
So just thinking about some internships I did. After my first year of university, I did an internship at a fashion PR company. And they were really lovely. They're called Purple PR. I think they still exist. I'm not sure. Maybe they do. But I worked for free. They paid my travel costs, I think. I'm pretty sure they did. But they had a really cool office. It was opposite Whole Foods in Piccadilly Circus.
I mean, when you're not paying people money, you can afford those offices.
although they didn't pay for my lunch, so that was really on me. But I remember on my last day, I brought in a chocolate cake I'd made, and they loved it, and I felt really proud of myself for that. but that was really fun. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to do that is because I thought, oh, my sister worked in PR, and she got loads of free stuff when she worked in PR, so I'll get loads of free stuff. I did not get any free stuff working at that place because their stuff was so high end. It was not stuff that could just be given away for free. My second year of university, what did I do? I can't even remember. I think I was just like home during the summer. I was like, I'm not doing any internship again. I'm good. And it was only in third year that I really started thinking about what I'm going to do afterwards. And I think it was one of my housemates, Holly, who's now still a really good friend of mine. She was doing mathematics. And so she was looking to go into like finance and stuff like that. And so she had to be applying for like grad schemes from really, really early on. And so because she was doing that, but she's always been super organized, because she was doing that, I was suddenly like, oh, I should probably start thinking about what happens after I leave here. Mm. I had a hilarious plan that 3 months after I left uni, I was going to move out of my parents' house. And I was going to have my flat in London. And I think about that plan and I laughed because I moved out of their house in 2021 and I graduated uni in 2015. Okay. So that 3 month plan.
3 months going on 6 years, but you know, we listen, we don't judge. Exactly. Okay.
You know, blessed plans and all that jazz. But so when she started doing that, I was like, okay, I need to get in gear. And I looked up grad schemes for publishing, and there were quite a few. And I didn't get any of them. And I think one of the reasons I didn't get any of them is because I remember particularly applying for the HarperCollins grad scheme. And they had a moment where it was all done by video, where you were sort of interviewed by video, but not by a person. It was a question came up, you had 30 seconds to think about your answer, and then you had, I think, 2 minutes to give an answer.
Mental.
Yeah, and I'd not really done a lot of interview prep. Oh, actually, do you know what? I tell a lie. In second year after uni, I interned for my parents at their law firm, and that was hilarious, because my mum, like, she was like, we're going to do this properly, I'm going to interview you. We couldn't keep straight faces when she was interviewing me. We were sat in the living room. Mm. I think I was dressed in like really cash clothes. She was sat there with her glasses on, her notepad and everything like that. And she was looking at me really serious, but I was just like looking up the whole time. Like, I'm sorry, I can't take you seriously. But she tried. She tried really hard to take it seriously. I think I interned for them for a little bit. But so I was doing all these interviews, and so I was doing the one for HarperCollins. And one of the questions came up and it said, if you were in an elevator with Charlie Redmayne, what would you ask him? 30 seconds came, I said, who the heck is Charlie Redmayne?
Charlie or Eddie Redmayne?
Charlie Redmayne.
Yeah, I don't know.
They're brothers.
Okay.
They're brothers. They're half brothers. Yeah, but Charlie Redmayne is the CEO of HarperCollins.
Oh, wow.
I'd done no prep. I'd done absolutely minus zero prep. And so I didn't know who that was. And so I scrambled on my phone quickly, Googling who Charlie Redmayne was. And then I can't remember even what I said was my question, but it was obviously terrible because I didn't get that internship. Didn't get the Penguin one. I think there was another one I applied for. Didn't get that either. And so instead I turned to Creative Access, which, if people don't know, is a really amazing, I think it's funded by the government to a degree.
Creative Access is great,
And it's essentially for Black, Asian, minority, ethnic people to try and get into the creative industries. And I applied again for a publishing internship through there. Didn't get it, but I did get a job in PR. Another job in PR. Again, I thought, free things. This time I did get free things.
Okay.
And I worked there for, I think, the whole period of my contract with them, which was 8 months. And then they asked me if I wanted to stay on. And I said no, because I wasn't using my brain. And that bothered my mother. And that bothered me.
So do you need an English degree to work in PR?
No, but I think you need communication skills. Okay. Because PR is literally about communications.
And, like, this is like new to me. What does the PR role actually entail? Because I think as I like hear PR, I'm thinking like bulletins, e-news, I don't know, Shade Borough. I don't know. That I'm just talking about what... Yeah. See, I'd failed the interview too. How would you define PR?
So I think it depends on the kind of PR you're doing and who you're doing it for. So we did do some personal PR at the company I worked for, Dundas Communications, but we also did PR for companies like Save the Children. I think we did it for Bugaboo, but I don't think I ever really worked on Bugaboo. And we also did it for the Weinstein Company.
Oh.
Yeah. And this was, I think, maybe a year or so before everything came out. But we did the BAFTA, the pre-BAFTA dinner. We did the Weinstein / the Weinstein Company's BAFTA after party. So it was really interesting.
You did it.
We helped to run this thing, so I went to both of those events. Okay. So there was a sort of guest list that I ticked off people when they came in for the BAFTA dinner, and I told them like which table they were sitting at. And then for the BAFTA after party, I was sort of checking off people and sending people to like the high table, so to speak, to go and hang out with the big dogs. But yeah, I wasn't really using my brain because I was essentially sending a lot of emails to people saying like, hey, could you do this? Would you like to interview this person? Could you place this, I don't know, this thing for like TK Maxx and
so it's a glorified admin. No offense to administrators.
Admin is important.
We listen, we don't judge. I'm going to say that now every time to make sure I don't get cancelled. Okay, so you do PR, you were there for 8 months, and then, yeah, where do we go from there?
And then because I wasn't using my brain, I was like, I'm just going to leave and I'm going to pursue publishing and see where I get to. And two of my friends, Grace and Liv, I remember they say, they look back on this and they say this was the most dramatic time of my life because I was unemployed, I think, for all of April. I think my contract finished maybe like mid-March and then I was unemployed for all of April and I acted like it was the end of my life. Bearing in mind, I was what, 20, I was still 21 at that point. Mm. And I was like, the sky is falling, I have nothing. Shout out Whitney Houston. And I was just acting like, I was just acting like everything was over. I was like, I was applying for loads of publishing jobs and I wasn't getting anything. And so I was just feeling really despondent about it. And then I got to the point, I was like, guys, I'm just going to apply to be a legal secretary because I can't get any other jobs. And they were like, okay. But they were just like, you're being so dramatic.
Yeah.
And now I think about it, and I know friends of mine who have been unemployed for like months and months at a time, I know that my 1 month was really nothing compared. Bearing in mind, I was living at home. My mum was making me pay £100 to her a month in rent. Mm. Nothing. Yeah. And so it really wasn't that big of a deal. But essentially, I'd been applying and applying and applying for stuff. And one of the women who worked at Creative Access at the time, Lisa Jonas, she was really kind. She knew I wanted to get into publishing and she sort of kept in contact with me. And she said, let's look at your CV. Maybe your CV is the reason why you're not getting any like replies. And it was. My CV was the problem. I was the problem.
Yep.
So she helped me to completely revamp my CV.
Love that.
And she was like, hey, I know some people who work in publishing. And publishing is, I don't know if it's still the same now, but it definitely used to be a it's who you know kind of industry. And so she was like, I know some people who work at Bloomsbury. I know you want to work in editorial, but this is not necessarily going to be a jump straight into editorial type of situation. You might have to just sort of get your foot in the door and then work your way around. So she knew people who worked in the business and information division. And so she was like, I think they've got a marketing intern role coming up. Would you like to? And I was like, for sure, whatever it takes, I'll do that. Bearing in mind, I'd applied for loads of jobs at publishing in between as well.
So was this all within the month? Don't tell me you got this in like May.
Yeah, I started it in May.
Wow. Because you really made this seem like it was so a year. Dramatic. It was years of tribulation, but all of this, I applied for so in a month. Yeah. You know what? I was employed.
That's why they were like, okay, you're unemployed for 1 month living at home and you had money. Why are we crying here?
My
it wasn't like I was like 67, hadn't been employed for like 12 years and was about to lose my house sort of situation.
I get that. And going back to like revamping your CV, I think it's such a big takeaway because, yeah, I actually did a post. Like, so me personally, I use a website called Job Hero, and Job Hero is insane. This is not an ad, although Job Hero bust me some peas though, because it's great. And basically, it has like wonderful templates, and now they use like AI. So if you're applying for an editorial role, it will give you, okay, our most successful applicants typically talk about this, and you can take the template and then tailor it to yourself.
Okay.
And I think for those people who might not have a CV that stands out, it's such a big thing. It's such an easy way. Yes, it does cost a little bit of money, but like, you can't put a price on getting a full-time job. And the fact that you were able to get that support from someone at Creative Access, I think it shows kind of the way you've got to think outside the box if your situation isn't changing, even though yours was only for a month. okay, so you become marketing intern at Bloomsbury. And then, yeah, let's go from there.
And honestly, I shout out Lisa, wherever you are, Lisa, you're amazing. And thank you so much for looking at my CV when you didn't have to. But yeah, working at Bloomsbury essentially started everything. That and also the fact that my best friend Grace was then working in Bristol at Rife magazine with a man called Nikesh Shukla, who's amazing. There's a book called The Good Immigrant. If you haven't read it, you should read it. It's fantastic. And she was working under him at this Rife magazine, which was run by sort of youth essentially. And he'd published books before and stuff like that. So she introduced me to him and she invited me to a day that they were having with Penguin, who were a publisher who were coming down to sort of talk to people about how publishing works and stuff like that. So I came down for that day, met Nikesh. He was like, cool, I'll mentor you. He's one of the most giving people ever, just of his time, of himself. He's amazing. And he said, oh, there's an organization starting up in publishing called Bayman Publishing, which was for Black, Asian, minority ethnic people who were working in publishing. He was like, it's run by these two people I know, Ming and Sarah. You should go meet them and see how that all goes. And I was kind of like, I don't like going places by myself. I'm different now. Yeah. But I didn't at the time. And so when I went to the first event, I bumped into someone called Angelique. And we were chatting. I was chatting with Angelique. I was like, oh, where do you work? She's like, I work at Bloomsbury. And I was like, I work at Bloomsbury. She was like, oh, that's so strange. We should go for lunch. Mm. And Angelique is still friends with me to this day. Mm. And she discovered that I wanted to work in editorial, and she was working in the editorial department as a managing editor.
Wow.
She was so kind that she allowed me to get a bit of experience by reading some manuscripts and writing reports for her so I could get a feel for what it was like to be in editorial. One of those manuscripts was a book called Home Fire by Camilla Shamsi, which way back in the day won the Women's Prize. So I read that book before it even like been published, and I still, as I am now, gloating about that to this day.
Yeah.
So I did that with her, and then in the meantime I still have applications from way back when that getting processed, whatever it is. And so in June I hear back for a job I've applied for in April at HarperCollins, working in their digital department, working on ebooks and audiobooks. Now on the job application it said, can you code? And I said yes, because I used to have MySpace. And, and so and you had to make things bold, and you had to copy the code to get a music player into my profile. So I was like, yeah, I can code for sure.
Whoa. Can you code? Yes, because I was able to do things on MySpace. I thought I'd heard it all. Garand. I thought I'd heard it all when man turned up. Man turned up at the job uninvited. But now we got no coders saying MySpace is coding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Don't worry, I was humbled on my first day.
Okay. So you did leave?
Yeah, I did.
Why would you though, when you got the support from the person?
Because that internship was for 3 months.
Okay.
And that 3 months was going to end in July. And so I started that job at HarperCollins in July, which was a permanent. Okay. Well, actually it wasn't permanent. It was for 1 year, but it was longer than the three months.
Yeah, of course.
And obviously I'd be getting paid more as well, because I was getting paid for the internship, but not a lot.
And just before like we get into what you're doing at HarperCollins, so when I hear publishing, you think books, and I know it can be magazine. What are the? There must be so many roles that you can do within publishing.
Yeah.
Can you just highlight some of the different roles that you can hold? Because I know you've spoken about editorial there, but give us a spectrum of what you can do in publishing.
Yeah. So the easiest way to break it down, I suppose, is to start from the book and then move to the author. So author writes a book. Author contacts literary agent. Literary agent sells the book or sends the book to multiple publishers. One publisher buys the book or buys the rights to publish the book, let's call it. And that means they can publish it in ebook, audio, physical, so paperback and hardback. Back in the day, way back in the day, publishers also sometimes bought the film rights, but agents are not stupid anymore, and so they don't let that happen. Mm-hmm. But agents also can then sell translation rights for that book in multiple different countries.
Yeah.
Book gets to publisher, and the first person to sit with that book is the editor. And so actually before the book is even acquired, so that means that the publisher then buys the rights to it, the editor will take it to something called the acquisitions meeting and talk through sales, marketing and publicity about the book, as well as finance, obviously, because finance needs to sign off on how much they'll pay them. An author will get paid something called an advance, which is short for an advance on royalties. So the idea is that you are paid a chunk of money to finish or write the book or whatever it is. And then after that, you need to sell a certain amount of copies in order to start earning royalties. Exactly. Most authors do not make back, don't start earning royalties and do not essentially earn out their advance, because the idea is that it's really hard to earn out your advance. It's really, really difficult.
Okay, wait, let's just talk about this, right? We don't have to talk about yours, but let's just talk about this in general, right? Yeah. So let's say you're an author, because we've not even got to that yet. Actually, do you know what? Let's save it. Let's save it. You continue.
Okay.
So you continue. We'll get there.
So anyway, that's how the sort of financial bit of that works. But author, editor starts working with author on the book. They work on manuscript. They work on, do all kinds of different edits to it. Then at the same time, sales, marketing, publicity are working on the book. Sales are working on it. They're talking to Waterstones. They're talking to different retailers. They're saying, hey, here are our 5 big books for the season. Here are some other mid-level books. Here are some sort of, they won't necessarily describe the books that aren't the big 5 books as their lower tier, but publishers and booksellers kind of know how that works. And so booksellers or publishers will have events. So they might have, I know that at HarperCollins, they'd have an evening for Waterstones, and they'd have, I think they'd have like a roadshow or some kind of thing where they'd bring a lot of their big authors, and loads of booksellers would be there, and they'd have advanced copies of the book, and they'd give them out to them so that booksellers can read them and really push them personally to readers. That's why sometimes when you go into a bookshop and you might ask a bookseller, hey, what would you recommend? They will generally have like real recommendations
because
for you.
Because they've been to like a roadshow.
Exactly. They'll also have read stuff they just wanted to read, but they'll generally have like recommendations of things.
Yeah.
So sales are working on that. Marketing is working on getting messaging out about the book. So spreading the word essentially to your average reader like me and you. And they're doing that through TikTok, Instagram. They're doing that through all the different kinds of ways. They're doing that through newsletters, all that kind of stuff. They're doing that through liaising with designers and having graphics made and having things like, this is a story you'll never forget, a love story for the ages, that kind of thing. Those kind of buzzy words, and they're bringing them out, and they're coming up with the hashtags. They're looking at the different locations in which certain books really hit and things like that. And then you've got publicity who are pushing the author. They're pushing the book, but they're also pushing the author. So
is publicity the same as PR or similar?
To a degree, but it's a different kind of... It is, essentially, but it's a different kind of beast, so to speak. Because... You are pushing the author as well, but you are essentially pushing that the book is what you want to sell, you want to push the most. So they're pitching to magazines to have it in their best summer books you want to read or five books to curl up with this summer. Mm-hmm. They're trying to push into conversation. So for example, if there's a conversation going around about women's healthcare and the book is about a woman trying to decide whether or not she wants to have a baby, they want to push that in there. They're talking to radio stations, they're going on podcasts, they're pushing the author out for all these kinds of different things. Yeah.
So many roles. Wait, just a couple of questions. So there's so many roles there.
And that's not even to mention, like, just because I feel like I should otherwise, because I know people like in art and design, like designing the cover.
Shout out Kieran Lewis, who we've had on. He is a creative who artwork for the front and back covers of books.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. And then production, who are the people who were looking at the specs and things like that and sending it off to the printers and making sure all the specs are right and make sure everything runs on time. And the people who essentially do workflow and make sure that we have the cover copy on time, we have the inside text ready on time, all those kinds of different things. They essentially, it's publishing is one gigantic wheel. It looks like it does just sometimes look like it's editorial or like sales, marketing, publicity, but without all those different people working together, things just don't run.
No, and I love that because, you know, a lot of times you'll ask somebody like, what is it you want to do? Mm. And they don't know. Mm. But even just by saying, you know, I want to work in publishing, there's so much there.
Yeah.
And it just shows, like, you don't need to know the specific job role you want.
Yeah.
You just need to have, like, a base for where you want to head.
Yeah.
But then whatever it is you decide or whatever industry it is you decide you want to go into, there are so many different roles. I wanted to say that. And then the two questions I had as you said that. One, with all of these different departments, is the money the same?
Yeah.
Or, like... I call it the laugh of honesty because I know when I'm hitting a nerve, I'm getting the laugh of truth. I assume that, you know, salespeople get a lot. How does the pay vary based on the different roles?
So it's not even so much based on the different roles, but based on the level you're at.
Okay.
And the thing is, the level that your job title says doesn't necessarily mean that that's the job you're doing. Generally in publishing, and I'm sure it's the same in any job role, to be honest, they always say that you need to be working at the next level in order to get the next job up. And that is doubly or triply true of publishing.
Wow.
They want you to be doing whatever it is you want to be getting paid for before you actually start getting paid for it. And those conversations can be really circular. They can say, and this is not me speaking about any one specific person, this is just sort of how the industry works, but they can say, okay, so you want a promotion and you're saying that you do this and this and this and this, but you need to be doing this and I need to be seeing more of this. And you can have that conversation 3 or 4 times before anything moves. And sometimes it'll be, hey, we're getting a pay rise. It'll just be in line with inflation, which is not really a pay rise. It's just you getting paid what you should be getting paid. But the more senior you get, essentially, the better your role is. And a thing that happens really commonly is that if you are really good at your job and they really want to keep you, and the best thing to do to immediately get a pay rise or a promotion is to get an offer from somewhere else. And that generally is the key to getting a better, higher paying, getting a pay rise sort of thing.
So you've got to shop around.
Yeah.
So that was my first question. And then the second question, as you were talking about like the roadshows and everything, I was thinking, all right, so imagine you're Stephen Bartlett.
Mm.
And he's just like in the last year brought out the 33 Laws of Business and Power, or I think it's called.
Is it actually called that?
Yes.
Is it a play on that 48 Laws of Power book?
I don't know. Maybe it's the 33 Laws of Business and Life.
Same kind of thing.
Harry, what's it called? Can we Google that while we talk? Because, that was Stephen's team going after me. I don't know, mate. Need to fact check. But what I was going to say is, okay, so say someone like him, right, you talk about the top five. So that means like Penguin, HarperCollins, they must be fighting for the rights to his book. Mm-hmm. And then is it once the publishing house gets the rights, they're the only ones that can distribute it? Is that how it works?
Within the territories that they've purchased, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So they basically get a monopoly.
Yeah. But wow. I suppose every publisher has that for whatever book kind of thing. Okay. But yeah.
So that means like... that means you can get a lot of money if you like go up because people are fighting for you. Okay, wow.
The more people interested, like it's likely that the more money you will get, essentially.
Okay, sick.
33 Laws of Business and Life.
Oh, yeah.
33 Laws of Business and Life, I got it.
Yeah, that is basically a play on the 48 Laws of Power.
Mate, he's quoted him back in the... Do you know what? A lot of... There ain't no new stuff in the world.
Really, they're just recycling.
Yeah, recycling, remixing. All right, so I've got like a great understanding on the different roles in publishing. I've understood the money with like the different levels. So you specifically, you went into editorial. If we could just talk about the different roles you held and like how did like your day-to-day change as you progressed?
So I started off incredibly overwhelmed because not only was I working for the imprint that I was working for, but I was also then working on a couple of other authors who didn't quite have an imprint. They were just sort of floating loosely, but they were quite big authors.
What does imprint mean?
So within a publishing house...
Because I thought Twilight as you said that. I thought
oh my gosh, like Jacob name? And yeah. Yeah,
so we need to be sure, you know.
It's not like an imprint, I promise you. This imprint is illegal. This is not any kind of bestiality type of nonsense. Sorry.
We listen, we don't judge.
I mean, we judge about bestiality. Okay, we do. That's not okay. Definitely not okay.
Sorry, okay.
See a therapist about that. But within a publishing company, it can work two ways, actually. Within a publishing... Within a publishing house, let's call... I'll do two different examples.
Yep.
Within Penguin is a publishing house, and within that, they have publishing companies. So they've got Vintage, they've got... what's the other one called that they've got? They've got Transworld. And so within Transworld and Vintage, they will have other imprints. So, for example, within Vintage, they've got Jonathan Cape, they've got Chatto and Windus, they've got... they've got a non-fiction... They've got loads of different imprints, stuff like that. HarperCollins is slightly different. Although now, technically, HarperCollins does have a publishing house underneath an imprint, with an imprint underneath it. But HarperCollins is more of a publishing company with then imprints and different sort of... Oh my gosh, what are they even called? There's a word for it, essentially, which is completely gone out of my mind. But there are different sections of the company. They're not called publishing houses, but they're sort of the different sectors. Okay. And then they've got different imprints underneath it. So, for example, there's Fourth Estate and William Collins. And underneath Fourth Estate and William Collins are Fourth Estate and William Collins separate imprints. There's Harper Fiction. And underneath Harper Fiction are Borough Press, the crime thriller team. I can't remember what they're called now. They're called something else. And then there's sort of something separate to that that's Avon. And then they've got Harper Nonfiction that's got different imprints underneath that as well. So they essentially break it down in that sort of way.
Okay. So sorry. And yeah, you were continuing about you were overwhelmed.
So I was overwhelmed. So I was doing a lot of work. I was also just jumping, being sort of thrown straight in. I was doing all the admin for the team. So that means that if my boss, and also I was sort of working as assistant to my boss. So if my boss got a manuscript in, I had to make sure I logged it in the submissions log. And if anyone else on the team got an email, a submission, they forwarded it to me. And they're like, can you log this, please? So always making sure I logged all the submissions that came in. That is kind of a quick-ish job. But if you let them pile up, then you have to really go back and check and look through. I also then had to make sure that it was kept updated. So if someone acquired a book, need to make sure it's updated. If there's a date that someone needs to get back, I need to put that in the notes. Sometimes my boss would say, hey, can you read this manuscript for me and report back? That means I have to go home. I don't necessarily have to read the entire manuscript. I have to read as much of it as I can, report back to her. I don't want her to then take my advice and find out 6 months later that that book is going to be a massive bestseller because somebody else bought it and they're going to do a massive campaign. I missed out on that kind of thing.
So how is it you determine that a book is really good? Because it's all subjective, right?
Yeah, but it's based on another thing that I was having to keep aware of. Trends in the market and what's selling and what's not selling. And then what's also going to be the next big thing. That's sort of something else I have to be keeping aware of. It's not something that I will know with absolute certainty, but it's just something I need to be keeping on top of. Okay. So not only am I supposed to be doing reading sometimes for my boss, and sometimes reading for other members of my team, but then also I should be doing my own personal reading and then reading to keep on top of what's going on in the market. Then I'm also essentially being a project manager for the team and making sure that I know what's happening with the text for a book. I've booked in a copy editor and a proofreader, and I've made sure that I've processed their invoices and I've gotten their purchase order numbers to make sure their payment goes through. I also need to make sure that we've briefed a cover, that we've got cover copy in time to go on the list. I also need to make sure that I've told the person who's in the design team that we're ready to brief a certain cover. I need to make sure that if I'm liaising with an authoring agent, that they've got approvals for certain things. I need to send out their finished author copies in time. If I'm sending the author proofs to look at before the book comes out, I need to make sure I've got the right address for them. If they've moved house, I need to make sure that's happened. If they've got a birthday coming up, I need to send a card to them. I've got to do all that stuff.
And just to be clear, is this like the first rung on the ladder as the assistant editor? Yeah.
Oh, no, as the editorial assistant.
As the editorial assistant.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's being done for various things. And then I need to take minutes at all the meetings. And then on top of that, I need to be working at the next level if I want to get the next job.
And that's what I was going to say. Yeah. Okay, so what is the next job? What is the next job, first of all?
The next job is basically a glorified version of what I'm already doing, but they allow me to do a little bit more. So they might say, okay,
What's it called first?
Assistant editor.
Assistant editor.
So they just flip those words around.
Okay. I just flip the switch.
flip. Hey. That's literally what that is. But that means they might allow me to do more things, like I could do a shadow edit, which is essentially the editor I'm working with won't have necessarily done their edit yet, but all they might have, and they'll send me what they've got on there. They'll send me the editorial notes and they'll send me the document they've got with all their comments and things like that in it. And they'll say, do you have anything to add? Do you have any other observations to make? But also allows me to look at what they're doing and see how they edit. Because I remember once I sat down with my boss, I was like, how do you edit a book? And she was like, great question. Nobody really teaches you. And then she sort of tried to explain it to me, but you really do just learn as you go. There's not a handbook or anything like that. I did get some training. They did send me on a training course to learn about copy editing and proofreading, which is not something I do some proofreading, but not for entire novels. I'll do it for like cover copy and things like that, and pieces of text that are going in, you know, like not pamphlets, but like presentations and stuff like that. So I need to know it for that kind of thing, but also to know what to look out for when we get copy edits back and stuff like that.
Okay. So I need to make sure I get this right. So the first one is editorial assistant.
Mm-hmm.
Next one is assistant editor.
Yeah.
As assistant editor, are you liaising more with the editor or with the editorial assistant?
Oh, sorry. I should have mentioned this. Just because I'm assistant editor doesn't mean they bring in a new editorial assistant.
I'm
at the editor stage, I'm basically still an editorial assistant.
Okay.
Yeah,
like that visibility.
Yeah.
Just in case she was wondering, why is nobody coming to take the load off me?
No, they're
okay,
not.
Okay, and then after assistant editor, you become full-blown editor.
You become editor or you become commissioning editor straight. I'm trying to even remember. It wasn't that long ago and I'm not that old. I think I did, maybe I did do editor and then commissioning editor, I think.
And how do those roles differ?
So by the time if I'm becoming an editor, then they will bring an editorial assistant then in underneath me to mean that I'm not doing as much admin. I might still be doing little bits of admin here or there, but I'm doing a lot less. And at that point, I'm then starting to go to and set up my own agent meetings. So meeting literary agents, letting them know what I'm looking for so that they can then send me submissions and I'm getting more on their radar and I can start to commission. So that is where you start to get a bit more autonomy as an editor. And then commissioning editor is you're fully blown, you're autonomous, you're doing what you want, you're building your own list, you're trying to flesh out things on the list and find gaps where you can infuse more life into the list and see what it is that is needed.
Do you get bonuses for this stuff?
There are bonus programs.
Get a laugh of truth, so
but
okay.
You
okay.
but it's so rare that you would get anything back from them unless you have a book that's like a million copy bestseller.
Yeah.
Which I know that some people have had.
Okay.
But I can.
So like, if you like got like Harry Potter or something like that,
yeah,
you are gonna get a little.
You are gonna, yeah, but that's okay. Only if by the time that book comes out, you have been signed onto the bonus program as an editor.
Okay.
But if you haven't, it sucks for you.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think I was signed onto it until I'd been commissioning for like 2 years, I think. Okay. But I suppose at one point I'd been an editor and then I was commissioning editor, so they sort of wanted to see what I was going
to
do.
I love this. And to the listener who is like, oh my God, my eyes are open. Like, for somebody who's looking to break into publishing, like, what would your key piece of advice be? there it is.
Save your money. I want to say stuff like, don't give up, keep applying. And that is true. Don't give up, keep applying. But it is also really hard. And I think you need to be willing to sacrifice a lot if you want to do that job. Be willing to sacrifice, like, and this is not me saying this as if it's a healthy thing, just to clarify. When I'm about to say, it's not me saying that this is healthy and this is good and advisable, but be willing to sacrifice your weekends. There will be events you'll have to go to. There'll be things you'll have to do.
Books you have to read,
things you're not really interested in, grunt work you have to do. You'll be getting teas and coffees for authors and you'll think, I'm in £36,000 of debt. Why am I getting teas and coffees for people? But you just have to, it's part of the job. Mm-hmm. And I would say, don't fix your eyes on editorial until you've tried another department first. If that's what you want to do, that's fine. But I would say try something else before you say, I 100% have to do editorial. Because it's not like
editorial. Do people glorify editorial?
Yeah, it's seen as really glamorous. In so many films, like, so-and-so is an editor, and this person's an editor, and it's really, really cool. And it's like, it is cool to a degree, but it's also really hard work.
Yeah.
And there was a really stupid list that came out that, and I say this is a stupid list. I don't think that the organisation that put it out is stupid, but I think the list was stupid. An organisation called The Bookseller, which is the trade magazine for book publishing, they put out a list of essentially the most profitable editors whose books had like sold the most copies or won the most prizes and things like that. And then they ranked those editors based on that at a time when people are being made redundant in the industry and buying books is getting harder and is getting to be a luxury essentially because the prices are going up. When I started working in publishing, hardbacks were $12.99. They're now $22.99 and they're just getting more and more expensive. And paperbacks were about, I think they started off around $7.99 when I started working in there. And they're now about, I think they're generally about $9.99 towards the like £11 essentially. And so that was just a really irresponsible list to post. And I think, I'm sure that they thought, oh, this is cool. Like, we're ranking people, seeing how well their books. And I'm happy for the people who are in that list. Like, it's great that you made it in. But actually what you're doing is putting a lot of people in jeopardy because then employers will use that list and say, oh, you weren't on this list this year, or like, you need to make this list this year, as if it's something that you can just click your fingers and make happen.
It's so funny you say that because the last episode who I filmed with, it was a lady called Melissa who is a host and presenter. And yeah, she like does interviews with Hollywood celebrities. Mm. But she said like, people see the glamour of me interviewing, you know, The Rock, Kevin Hart, but she was like, that is such a small fraction of my role. She was like, 90% of my job is like editing and project managing and this and that, and it's very lonely. And it's like, yeah, there's so much stuff which is glamorized, but it's such a small percentage of what you actually do that people need to go into these things with their eyes open, which is why we do this. Before like we get into like the authoring, with the work that you did and the years you spent in publishing, do you have any crazy work stories that you can share?
Yes, but I'm going to tell it slowly so I don't incriminate myself and destroy my reputation. Apart from those who already know this story. So when I was an assistant editor, so I was still doing, and maybe this is why this happened, because I was doing two jobs, essentially. You know, I was trying to break into whole like being an editor and I was still doing all the admin and stuff like that. There was an author we were working with on a new edition of their book. Really good book, great book, love that book. Love that author, great author. We were really tight on deadline and we were trying to get everything ready to send off to press. This author wanted to make a last minute change to the copy that was going on the back of the book. And we'd already written out the copy. They just, I think, made like two or three tweaks, which had sort of been pre-approved anyway. So I went into that email, I copied and pasted what they'd written, and I just popped it in the document online where you updated the cover copy. Art, they're not proofreaders. It's not their job to proofread. Their job is to just take the text, put it on there, move on, send it off to press. They send it off to press. It comes back. There is a glaring typo.
Hey!
Glaring typo. And I got in big trouble. And thank God my boss was really nice about it, but the higher ups, I remember one of them came up to me with a book and they were like, how did this happen? And I was kind of like, I know this is a rhetorical question, but I can explain something.
Slap on the wrist.
Yeah, kind of. I think it was just the crushing guilt that I felt was really bad. And that book went to press and they printed like a few thousand copies of it. Wow. With the typo. And that book did not go to the warehouse first, and like the publisher's warehouse, and then to the bookshops. It went straight to the bookshops. So a few years ago, I could have gone into a bookshop and found a copy of that book with a typo on it.
That was me.
And I felt so bad about that. And yeah, it was just so bad. And I really learned my lesson.
No. Do you know what? It's so funny you say that, because yeah, I thought that all books were like void of error. But I've definitely read books where I'm like, that didn't make sense. That didn't make sense. And sometimes I'm like, huh? I'm really back. I'm like, surely they caught it. But no. clearly sometimes these things happen. But okay, thank you for all of that. And whilst you're doing all of this, because I know that it wasn't always your plan, knowing you, to be an author. So can you talk to me, like, when is it you start thinking about this career? Transitioning away from publishing, like, yeah, talk through that transition.
Yeah, so it's funny, I don't think I ever thought I would completely stop working in publishing, and I still haven't technically. Okay. Because I do some freelance editing still, but you remember Angelique from earlier? She's relevant now.
Yeah.
I mean, she's still relevant. She's always relevant. Love Angelique. But she I was just sort of, I was still dabbling a bit, and I think maybe there was a bit of maybe mundanity to my job, and it, a bit of the everyday, and everyday was just kind of like, oh gosh, doing this again. And I think I also was getting to a point, I hadn't reached there quite yet, but I was thinking, gosh, I'm trying to kick through some walls, I'm trying to get more diversity into what we're publishing and this kind of thing, and it's just moving really slowly and we're coming up against the same hurdles. So maybe there was part of that in why I was writing a little bit more, but I sent it to Angelique. I thought, I know Angelique's got great taste, so I sent some of what I'd written to her, and she says, oh, this is really good, you should send it to a literary agent. Literary agent I mentioned earlier, second part of the whole process. I said, oh, it's not finished yet, but okay, I can do that. And a lot of the times agents will ask for a finished manuscript, not a partial manuscript. So I was kind of shocked that she was saying I should send it even though it wasn't finished. But I said, okay, I'll send it to some people. And she said, send me the list of who you're going to send it to. Because at that point, I'd become aware of agents and things like that. So I sent her a list of, I think, four people. And she said, okay, make sure you send it to this person in particular as well. I was like, okay. This person who she told me to send it to, wow, I'm really linking these stories together. Well, I'm just realizing this person she told me to send it to was someone who I'd also met, but not really chatted to properly, at the first Bayman publishing event where I'd met Angelique in the first place. And that woman's name was Nikki Chang, and she is my literary agent to this day.
Shout out Nikki. Let's go.
She just had a baby, so shout out her as well. Had a baby. And so I submit to Nikki. Nikki responds really quickly and's like, thanks for sending this, I'm going to read it ASAP. We go for a coffee and we talk about the book. And she comes to that meeting with like three or four pages of notes on the book, and I was kind of like obsessed. Yeah. Like, but also like in a good way, like, yeah, she seems really, really keen.
Yeah.
And she's also not keen to the point of pressure. She's like, what do you want your career to be, what is it that you want to do? And I was like, oh, I would like to sort of be an editor at large, still doing some editing, but I'd also like to, I feel like, get into writing a bit more and maybe eventually do screenplays and things like that. And she's like, cool, I want to help you do that. But she's also not pushy about it. She doesn't say, cool, I really want it and now you have to sign with me. She's like, think about it, take your time, talk to some other people. I left the meeting and I was like, it's her, like, I know it's her, like, I'll wait to get some emails, but whatever, it's her. I got one rejection from someone, and then another person emailed just after I'd signed with Nikki and was like, oh, I'd love for you more, and I was like, you're too late.
Yeah.
But it didn't just go smooth sailing. I suddenly get a book deal from there, and I had to tell my boss that I, by the way, I've got a literary agent now, just in case they're like, it goes on submission and they're kind of like, why didn't we get this sort of thing?
Yeah. How did your work respond to that?
She was like, everybody's writing a book these days, because it is really common for editors to then suddenly become authors.
Okay.
It's like, I'm really basic in that sense. There's nothing original about that whole trajectory.
Yeah.
But it took actually a really long time for me to find a story that was authentic and that I really enjoyed writing, because people ask me a question all the time, which is, how did being an editor help you to write a book? And I was like, actually, it kind of hindered me at first.
Oh, really?
Because I was so focused on the trend and what was selling. And so I was trying to write that kind of thing.
You're trying to hack the algorithm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was trying to beat the system. And it just didn't work. It wasn't authentic. I didn't enjoy it. And the book that actually I signed to Nikki with was probably quite authentic, but I sort of fell out of love with it. I did fall out of love with it after she sent me a bunch of editorial notes on it. So maybe that was part of the problem.
Yeah.
But I just, I then went through like 5 or 6 or 7 other ideas and nothing stuck. And Nikki, bless her heart, she was so patient. I signed with her, I think, in early 2018. And I didn't send her anything that she could send out until late 2020.
Okay.
And that was really, really pivotal, actually, because I think in that time, I was really forced to experiment and figure out what's my voice, what is it that I like to write, what is it that I'm interested in, what is it that I want to say, and how do I say that in a way that is unique and different to everything else that's out there. So that was really important to have that time and space. And yeah, bless her, she was really patient with me about that.
And like, just on that, like the creative process, you know, I'm going to talk about Stephen Bartlett again, just because he said that he went to like Thailand for 3 weeks and just head down in the trees and was able to smash out his book. The 2 years that you're spending understanding like your voice and how it is you want to put pen to paper, what does that process look like? Because I like to ask a question like, yeah, like, can you spot creativity out of thin air? Or is it like a systematic process that that breeds the results? Like, what is your experience with creativity?
I've learned, A, with book one, and now definitely with writing book two, my process is to fail and fail and fail again until I succeed. And that might mean writing loads of different entire books or a couple of different, like, sections of books, and then I might read it again and be like, no, don't like it, read it again, no, don't like it, this doesn't feel authentic, that kind of thing. And that is essentially my process, to fail and fail again until I succeed.
So like, but okay, if we just take a step back, before you like write a whole book, is there like, okay, I want to write about a couple with a friend, or you know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. Or like, I want to write about family, and then we go from family, like, what is like the top underpinning, I suppose, North Star,
the sort of light bulb moment?
Yeah,
I'm going to sound a little bit pretentious, I suppose. Did you ever watch that documentary that Beyoncé did? I can't remember for what album it was. Maybe it was... Oh, I think it was the self-titled album. And there's this clip of her saying, I see music. And when she said that, I was kind of like, okay, babe. But I get it now because I feel like I see stories.
Okay.
I can look at two people on the tube and be like, oh, I wonder what... Like, there's a story there. There's something happening there. Literally anything can spark like an idea. And so I think sometimes I would just be watching something, an idea would come like, oh, I want to write about that. Once I wrote a good 20,000 words of a novel that was based on just like 2 or 3 lines of an episode of The West Wing.
Oh, wow.
And just a whole novel idea sparked from that. And so it can literally be anything like that that can just breed an idea. And then suddenly light bulbs go off and I start thinking about how I make this work.
I love that. And are you like, so are you carry a notepad everywhere with a pen and a note down?
Oh, okay. On my
so
phone.
You're just like,
I want to be a notepad person. And I used to be obsessed with stationery. At uni, I wasted so much of my loan on stationery and I never used it. Because I would just take my laptop and I'd just be typing, and because it was just so much quicker. And then I'd just take my phone, Notes app. Notes app is my best friend. If I ever lose that Notes app, woe is me, because I'll be in serious trouble.
Do you know about Notion?
Yes, I do know about Notion.
Do you use Notion?
I do not use Notion.
Okay, Notion. Look, I'm really coming for the sponsorships. This is the second one. Job hero, Notion. You're getting the drift, guys. We need help.
I did use Notion for a project, though, when I was at HarperCollins. I did use it for one project, and it was good.
Yeah, because it's very good for note-taking. Yeah. And, like, Ali Abdaal, the way he, like, puts his book notes in. I'm like, good for you, bruv, not me. But, like, if you're about that life, it looks like it could be good. But, okay, all right. So, the stories come to you, and then talk to me about, the creation of this first book.
So, I was really helped by the fact that it was lockdown. And also, actually, the fact that I was furloughed. I can't even believe that I remember that word, because it feels like a whole entire universe ago. But I was furloughed from, I think, end of March to, I think, beginning of August. And that time was weird because I couldn't do anything.
Yep.
I was paid not to work. And it was really odd. And I knew that it was basically just a tax loophole for publishing companies, various companies. But anyway, it was really strange. But in that time, I had time to fail and fail again. So that's what I did. And I think one of the things that my agent said that really stuck with me, I sent her, again, I think maybe 20 or 30,000 words of a novel. And I was trying to basically write a book like One Day. Have you heard of the book One Day? By David Nichols, they made it into a TV show and a film years before that.
Yeah, yeah.
I was trying to write something like that. That is not authentic to me. That is authentic to David Nichols. And that's why I should have just stayed in my lane. But I think if I hadn't tried that, I wouldn't have then got to where I was. But I sent her that and she was like, it's just not working for me. And I was like, you could just try and make it work, you know, like you could try a little bit. But she was like, I need you to find something that's like, I think she said the word authentic to you or something along those lines anyway. I was kind of like, I don't even know. I don't know what me is. It was years later in therapy that I realized I didn't know who I was, but that's a different story.
No, but you say it's a different story, but I think, yeah, like authenticity, people struggle with that. So yeah, how is it you went about finding your voice? Just failing.
Woo way of saying it, but it came to me genuinely. Okay. I think because I was fellow, I was watching a lot of TV. Insecure was still on TV. Love Insecure. Mm. And it's also my best friend and I were bored. Grace and I were bored during lockdown. We tried all kinds of things. We tried to learn to juggle with socks and tangerines. We tried all kinds of nonsense. And so we would just have conversations and things like that. And also, again, because I was bored, I went on Hinge. Don't do that when you're bored. Yeah, don't do it.
No promotion. We don't need
a place to waste your time.
We don't need that piece. We don't need it that bad.
Protect your piece. Don't go on Hinge. But I met someone on Hinge and I was talking to them and I was talking to Grace about this person. And I said to Grace, oh, really like him. Da, 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 da. And she was like, she made a joke, kind of. She said, oh, now you're going to get a boyfriend. I'm never going to see you. You're going to spend all your time with him. And I was like, I was like, he will have to understand that you come first and then he's second, which again, half a joke. Because Grace and I are like this. Then it just suddenly occurred to me, I was like, oh, that's an interesting dynamic. And as an editor, I talked often to agents about how I like stories about human nature and why we do the things we do and why we behave in certain ways. And I love other people's mess. I don't like having my own mess in my personal life, but I love other people's mess. And so I just thought, oh, that'd be an interesting dynamic, actually, if there was a person who had a partner or a husband or whatever it was, and their best friend just did not get on with them.
Mm.
And the first line of the book, which is Temmie Comes Over at 12, is the first line that I wrote, and it stayed that way. And I'm so glad it did, because I was I was asked twice to change it to like midday or 12 p.m. And I said, no, Temmie Comes Over at 12. That's just baseline. Like, that's just how it starts.
That seems very, like, is it Clockwork Orange or something like that? Is it
the
clock strikes 12 or something?
Oh, 13. I think it's...
any inspiration there or no?
Not at all. Oh, yeah.
Cool. So that was me just trying to do a little something there.
But I was just suddenly like, oh, I'd love to see that kind of messy, terrible dynamic. And so it just sort of literally spiraled from there, essentially. And I came up with one perspective and then I got to a point where I was like, I'm bored with her. I want to see what the other two are saying. And then I started working on their perspectives. But I think because that idea came so organically, not that the other ones didn't, but it came organically, but out of real life, something related to me. Although it was funny at one point that person who's an ex now, I saw them, I was like, I'm writing this book and it came out of this idea, but it's not about the whole situation. And he was like, well, it kind of sounds like it is. And I was like, touched a nerve there, clearly. It was so much fun to write it. And I think I hadn't enjoyed writing any of the other things I was writing. And I think that's what I needed to find. I needed to find the enjoyment. And I've also discovered I needed to find the characters and they needed to feel real to me.
Mm.
And I think because I rooted them in a sort of reality, although Grace is nothing like the best friend in the book, to clarify,
that's what I was gonna ask.
She's one of the nicest people you will ever meet.
Okay.
And the ex, whatever he's done, he's not the person in the book either. Mm-hmm. Nobody is anybody. But it was a jumping off point from a reality that I was in. And so I think that helped me to sort of root it in a kind of reality. And ever since then, I felt like a lot of ideas that I've sparked for books have come from conversations, because that one came from a conversation. And then the idea for book two also has come from a conversation. So
I love that. And just going back to book one, we'll touch on book two. So you mentioned that first sentence, from penning the first sentence to penning the final words of the book. How long was that process?
For the first draft... And let me just say, this is a fluke. And it certainly took me a lot longer to write book two. But for book one, because again, it was lockdown, couldn't go anywhere, couldn't do anything, didn't learn to juggle successfully, had reached the end of the internet. It was a little over a month.
Wow.
But I was doing something called NaNoWriMo, which is called National Novel Writing Month. And that is something that happens usually every November. And so I started writing it maybe like 12th of November-ish, mm-hmm. maybe around that time. And then I sent it off to my agent, really rude, on like the 23rd of December. She obviously didn't look at it until after Christmas. Mm. But I was like, woo, I'm done, bye. And just dashed. I didn't even read through it. But I think what she'd asked me to capture that I finally found an ability to capture was an authentic voice. Because one of the first things she said to me when she called me up about it, it was funny. I'd finished work. I was closing my laptop at my parents' dining table. She calls me up. And normally we schedule in our calls. So I was like, why is there someone calling me right now? I was like, hi. She's like, hey, how are you doing? And I was like, why is she calling me? Just get to the point. And she's like, oh, yeah. I was like, I'm good. And she's like, oh, cool, yeah. I was like, how are you? She's like, yeah, I'm good. I was like, cool. And then she says, so I just wanted to call. I finished reading the book. I loved it. And I was like, thank God for that. Because in my mind, I was like, if this book isn't good, she's going to dump me. She had never thought about that. And she never even said it. But that was just in my mind. I think I was just fearful of that.
So is that like a worry for authors that your agent will dump you?
Yeah, it can be.
And is that because it's like a waste of time to read books that aren't sellable?
Well, it's not even necessarily that. It's just, I guess sometimes there can be a mismatch of ideas. Like, you might want to go in one direction. Your agent might be like, this is not the correct direction. We need to go in a different direction. Understood. Completely. Also, sometimes authors and agents can just not be doing their job. Author is either not delivering on things that they're going to deliver on. Agent can be doing the same sort of thing. And agents can have a lot of clients. So if they're not giving an author the time that they need or deserve, that can also be a reason to be like, I want to go for somebody else.
That makes sense. And then, all right, so it took just over a month. Mm-hmm. And then talk about the process from there, right? Because your agent reads it, she finally loves it, but that's not the finished stage, right? There's like revisions.
Yep.
Revision upon revision. And then whilst this is going on, your agent is now taking the book and trying to pitch it to publishing houses?
So first, because she likes to do edits with her authors, we do, I think, 2 or 3 rounds of edits together. And then it gets to, I think we do 2 rounds, and then it gets to being the 3rd round of edits. And she said, okay, we can either do a 3rd round or we can send it out to publishers and put it on submission. And I was like, please go put it on submission. I need somebody to pay me to do these revisions at this point, because I'm working full time doing these revisions all the time. And I was like, it's getting much. I need to do something else. And so that's when then she moves to start sending it out to publishers.
Okay. And this brings us to what we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. about payment as an author. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier in the conversation that you get an advance, and what is it you said, that most authors, they don't ever pay back the advance. So yeah, talk to me about payment as an author.
Yeah, so authors will get something, like I said, called an advance, which is an advance on royalties, or advance against royalties, technically, I suppose it's called. But it's not that the author has to pay back their advance, but the idea is that they're supposed to earn out their advance. Okay. The thing is, the author will know what they've been paid as their advance, but they will not know what it is that they have to earn in order to earn out their advance, because that information is not given to them.
That's mad.
They will.
That's legal?
They will say in a contract the different royalty brackets. So for example, up to 5,000 copies of your paperback sold, for example, and this is just me pulling figures out of thin air because I haven't looked at a contract in forever, but they might say up to 5,000 paperbacks sold, you might get 10% royalties. Then up to 10,000 hardbacks sold, you might get up to 15% royalties. And then from 25% onwards, you'll get 20% royalties.
Wow.
But you will not know that what is called your profit and loss sheet, which is what the publisher uses to measure how many copies they think you'll sell, how much they think they'll have to spend on sales and marketing publicity, that actually you need to sell 35,000 copies of a hardback, 50,000 copies of your paperback, 10,000 ebooks, and 4,000 audiobooks before you can start earning out. But you won't know that information.
Wow.
I do think, though, that actually it's better that authors don't know that, because I think there's going to be then a pressure that you need to do all kinds of different kinds of jiggery pokery in order to sell those copies when your main job is to sell and promote the book. The actual buying of the book that people do is up to your publisher to sort out. There's only so much you can do apart from writing the best book that you can write.
Okay, so, and then that advance they give you, I have a friend, and I won't name the friend, but I know that they got a publishing deal, and they got like, I think it was like 50,000. And then when the publishers are selling the book, they'll take what, 20%, or you'll get 20%. And so like 35,000 books, mm-hmm. maybe have to, like you said, if you sell that, you're getting a fraction of it. It's not even like 50-50.
From the royalties,
it's like 10-20%. It's crazy. So yeah, the numbers that this.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot of money.
Yeah.
But if you don't write, if you write one book every 2-3 years, I mean, I know you're one a month, so you know, we good. Okay, so you get that. You get that advance. You've gone through the, this process. The book has been taken up. What happens next? Like, the book is launched. What are the emotions you're feeling when that first book hits the shelves?
I will answer that, but first I should just say that in terms of an advance, actually, you don't get that advance in one big fat chunk. It's usually, if you are doing a two format deal, so like hardback and paperback, you actually get that payment in four chunks. So you'll get a chunk on signature, like usually a quarter of it or just over a quarter of it on signature. Then you'll get another quarter when you have finished doing all the editorial elements and like they can essentially go and print the book now. Then you'll get another chunk when the book comes out in hardback, and then the final chunk when the book comes out in paperback. Oh, but just so people know, you do not just get a lovely chunk of money. It's kind of like with the lottery. If you win the million, they're not just going to give you the million straight up. You get the chunks. Yeah, no.
Okay, wait, let's not digress. I've been playing for Euro Millions all this time, making 100 M's straight in my bank.
You get it in chunk. And I think, to be honest, they do it so that you don't then get charged massively. You don't get hugely as much as you would. Because if you get a million, you'd basically just give 50% away to the government.
Yeah, that's facts,
and they'd be
facts.
Thanks for that. Well done.
That's facts.
But the emotions I'm feeling are, let me try and think back to a therapy session I had before the book came out. I was feeling excited but nervous. I was feeling pressure, I think, and I was feeling amazed that I had written a book and it was coming out, because I'd seen the process from the beginning from loads of other authors I'd worked with doing it. And so to actually get there, I was like, okay, this is pretty cool. This is pretty huge. And I think the culminating moment was I had a book launch, like a launch party. And we weren't 100% sure that I was going to have one, but then my publisher really did a great job and pulled it together. And I'm not married, but a load of my friends said that launch was like a wedding because, number one, it was genuinely by accident, but I was late. And so I got there and then everyone was like, oh, and I was like, oh no, this is not how I intended it to be. But I had like my family there. I had friends there. I had work friends there, like non-work friends there.
Did you read a chapter?
No, thank God. I did do a speech though, in which I forgot to thank my agent. And then afterwards she was like, sorry, I have to go. And I was like, oh my gosh, Nikki, I'm so sorry. I forgot to thank you.
Did she actually have to go?
She actually had to go because she had her child at home. Okay, she had to go see her child.
Nikki, look, you're getting thanked now. You're the best.
Okay. But when I saw her and she came up to me, I was like, oh my gosh, Nikki, I forgot. She was like, it's fine. I was like, it's not fine. But it was just amazing to have that many people in the room and to just feel so celebrated, but I think also really proud that I was there in that moment and that people were buying the book. And I think we brought 100 copies of the book to the launch party and we sold out of all of them, which was great.
And then on that, like when the book hits the shelves, like, you know, you speak about, I don't want to call it recoup, but you know, you want to set yourself targets, right? Yeah. How closely are you tracking sales and what does that do to your mental?
I do not track sales and I do not ask for my sales figures. I deliberately do not ask. I was told once and I didn't want to know. And then I was told and I was like, I wish I didn't know that information.
Okay.
But I don't pay attention. I don't have access to it. Thank God. And I never want access to it because I think that me focusing so much on sales figures is me losing sight of what it is that I'm supposed to be doing, which is working on writing the best possible book. And I think if I focus on sales figures, I just regress and I take myself back to when I was trying to write what I thought would sell the best.
Yeah.
And then I become inauthentic and I try to write something that is not me and does not work. And it's clear from the writing that it does not work. So I avoid it at all possible costs.
Anybody who's listening to this and they potentially want to write their own book, what is like the first step they should take and what advice do you have for them?
Read widely. But also look at other mediums. I think watching films and TV shows and being influenced by them is not a bad thing. I think some people can sort of sniff at that and be like, why would you do that? But nowadays publishers use TV shows as a way to market their books. I remember when my editor or my agent was sending my book around, I think she described it as Insecure meets something else. I can't remember what it is that she used, the other thing that she used, but she described it and I was like, oh, I like that description. You could use that. Yeah. Oh, maybe it was a book called, I think it was Such a Fun Age, which is an amazing book by an author I really, really love, called Kylie Reid. I think she described it as Such a Fun Age meets sort of Insecure. And I thought that was really fascinating and a really great description of it. And so I think there are so many things that you can take from those different mediums. So I would say read widely, but also look at loads of other different types of mediums of like art and things like that that you're interested in. I would also say, which is really hard because I still do it even though I tell people not to, don't compare yourself to other writers. Everybody's journey is different. I do still compare myself because it's really hard not to. And especially when you're making friends with other authors, you're going around and you see some people having massive success and you see some people having the same amount of success as you, which might not seem like a lot, but the fact is you have gotten to a place, and some people take ages to get to this place as well. And it's not to say that publishing a book is the peak of success, and if you don't get there, you're a failure, because that's not it. I think writing anything and completing it is a huge success.
100%.
I say that as someone who started and not finished like 12 books. So, but I think for me, when I'm thinking about it and thinking, oh, I wish I'd done this and I wish I'd had this experience that this person had, I've finished a book, I had it published. That's amazing. And I'm so proud of that. And I remembered actually that before the book came out, I was talking to my therapist about this and I was like, I'm scared. I know that I have to think about what my own metric of success is so that I don't hold on to the publishing world's metric of success, which is Sunday Times bestseller list, 15,000 copies sold, blah, 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 awards, awards, awards. Because if I hold on to that, I will never be satisfied and I will always think of myself as a failure.
What is your metric of success?
People reading the book. And to this day, I still get people messaging me or tagging me in a post on Instagram being like, just pick this book up. Or people just randomly messaging me like, I love this book. This was so fantastic. Thank you so much. When is the next one coming out? Or someone messaging my website saying, I read this book and I loved it. It was amazing. Thank you so much. And people wanting to do that in the first place, I love.
Yeah.
And just knowing that people are reading it. And I'm like, oh, okay, so people are still actually buying copies of the book. It's not just like sitting there languishing on the shelves getting dusty. Yeah, like people are picking it up. And that is amazing to me. And the fact that there are conversations I can have, like this conversation I can have, and conversations going to book clubs. I love doing book club events. I think they're so much fun. Particularly shout out Casual Readers Book Club, run by India Chambers. That's a great,
we'll link it.
That's a really, really great book club.
Depending on how big they are, will depend on whether we ask for royalties from that as well. So we've got to check.
They're great. And actually they're a great example of an organization that doesn't just do books, because they also will take some of their members like out to go and see plays, and they'll like work with National Theatre and go and do stuff like that as well, give people access to different mediums. But people reading the book, because I remember I got a really, really negative review before the book had come out actually, and it really, really hurt me. And I was just like, okay, I need to just like step away from this and like not engage with this so much. But then I thought to myself about it and I was like, actually, do you know what? And even now when I see negative reviews, if I see them, because I certainly don't search them, because again, protecting my peace. Yeah. But if I see them, I think to myself, but you paid for my book. So really,
jokes on
I've
you.
Won. Yeah. Yeah.
People sometimes go out of their way for that stuff. And it's just like, why?
Yeah. I don't mind a negative review if they're like, I didn't like the story, I didn't like the characters. But when they start nitpicking at things like, this is rubbish and this doesn't do this, I'm like, you can just say you didn't like it.
Yeah.
That's okay. You don't need to like everything. It's that's like fine. Nasty. But you don't need to... Someone made a really personal comment in one of their bad reviews and I was like, you don't know me. We've never met. So I don't know where this is coming from, but you need to take this to somebody else. This is not a me issue. No. Never respond.
And just on that, like, as an author, are there any like misconceptions about the job?
Yeah, that we just sit around reading all day. Or like sometimes I do see, though, I think it's not helped by some of the author profiles I see where people are like, what's your writing process? And they're like, I wake up at 6 a.m. I have a cigarette. I go and sit out in the garden. I read. I look at the birds. I quote some Yeats to myself. And then I come back to my writing desk and I write, you know, for like 2 hours. Then I go outside, have another cigarette, poke some Edgar Allan Poe, come back, have like 6 coffees. And I think that just doesn't really help because that just perpetuates a stereotype that's false. We struggle. We struggle and we strive. And it's really hard. And I think people also just think that we sit down and we just go, right, story, finish, the end. We don't. I think like I do as well, people fail and fail and fail again. And then you find something that works. And I think people also think that when someone says, oh, it took me 20 years to write this book, that someone was just sat there for 20 years writing and that's all they were doing. No, they were going to a full-time job. They were doing all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm in a privileged position where I can write most of the time, but then I also do some freelance work. But a lot of people are still doing full-time jobs because the way that they're being paid is not enough to sustain them to just write. Mm. So essentially every conception about authors is a misconception.
Yeah, I love it. And then obviously you mentioned the fact that you're on your second book. When does the second book come out?
Great question.
Is it finished?
I have finished writing the first draft of it.
Okay. then it's fine if we don't have a date.
Oh, yet. No, I just want to look down the camera at my editor, Jaker. She's not going to be listening to this because she has things to do. Yeah. But Jaker, if you're watching this, if you're listening to this, I just want to let you know. I want the book to come out in 2026. I know you want it to come out in 2027, but I want it to come out in 2026. I just want you to know that this is what I want. I know that this will not work as a means by getting you to change your mind, but I just want you to know that that's what I want.
And like, just as we wrap up, like, what are the learnings you've taken from the first book that have gone into the writing of the second book, and how do you think you've evolved as an author?
Ooh, I think autonomy is very important for me. I think I listen too much to other people's opinions. That's not to say on book one I listened to too many people's opinions, but I think as I got into the process of writing book two, I was like, this needs to be bigger and bolder and better and this and that, and I need to be more like this, I need to be more like that, and that was just not right, and that was not me at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that contributed to the fail and fail and fail again. But again, I think that's part of my process. So I think that's kind of, I think part of my process has also been humbled and me thinking, yeah, I can just write this book and I'm going to smash it out. My friend Amara is one of my best friends. She always tells me that I create unrealistic timelines for myself. And we went away and she's a freelance graphic designer. So she was doing graphic design and I was writing, trying to write book two. This is back in 2022.
Okay. So it's been a 2-3 year.
Yeah. I said to myself, I'm going to go there and I'm going to come back. We were there for 4 weeks. She was like, I'm going to go there, I'm going to come back with a finished draft. And she was like, are you? Yeah. She's like, unrealistic timelines. And I was like, no, I'm going to do it. I had like a mental breakdown while we were there. And I was struggling so bad. And I've completely dashed that book, essentially. And I dashed another one after I wrote that. It takes time. And
is writer's block a thing?
Yes, but I think what actually writer's block is asking you to do is to step away for a minute. I don't think it's asking you to push through. And I think that's the thing that a lot of writers think that they're supposed to do. And they think that they're doing something wrong if they cannot sit there and write consistently for like 12 hours at a time.
Like,
or whatever
it's a bit
it is.
Like overtraining. Yeah. It's not by force.
Exactly.
Like, just take a break.
If the word isn't coming to you, even if it's mid-sentence, just stop. Go away. Come back. Sometimes the sentence will complete itself. Sometimes the sentence will say, delete me. I don't need to be here. But I think I was I used to be a let's push through, let's push through, let's push through. But now I'm like, actually, just stop. And it'll come back to you, and whatever you need to do, you'll do.
All right, this has been like just wow. As we round out this part of the conversation, like to book lovers, literaries, just people who enjoy the craft. Like, what would your final takeaway or piece of advice be to people?
Oh, it's the thing I always say, and I feel like I sound a bit like a parrot when I say this, but this is something my parents would definitely say: be gracious to yourself. There are so many different kinds of pressures that we put on ourselves and that the world puts on us. And we have so many expectations and things that we believe we should be doing, things that we believe we should be achieving. We compare ourselves. It's hard not to. We create unrealistic timelines for ourselves. But you have to be gracious to yourself. Whatever takes time, takes the time it's going to take. You can try and speed up that process, but the process will take as long as it takes.
I love it. We have a quick fire round. Mm-hmm. Are you ready? We're supposed to do this at the start.
I'm not ready, but we'll go anyway.
I'm just going to go, favourite author?
Teju Cole.
Favourite book?
Actually, I have to go back and say Teju Cole / Kylie Reid.
Okay.
Favourite book? Every Day's for the Thief.
Write a first draft in one intense month or perfect a single chapter over a year?
Ah, rent to pay, month.
Have a viral debut with harsh critiques or critical acclaim with minimal sales?
I can't say I got critical acclaim, but let's go with the second one.
Have a massive social media following or deep connections with 100 devoted readers?
Ooh, deep connections.
And be known for one iconic novel or 20 well-regarded books across genres?
I'm going to go for the second one.
Okay. Have financial stability from predictable series or creative freedom with niche projects?
I'm sorry, what does that freedom mean? Does that mean I don't pay rent and that I don't have a home? I don't know what that means.
You know what? I'm moving on. Have an effortless but anonymous writing process or a grueling but celebrated one?
Anonymous. Leave me alone.
I love it. And then finally, dream dinner guest.
I'm going to say my grandparents, all four of my grandparents. I've got one left now, but they've all done really interesting things in their careers. My dad's dad was a judge. My dad's mum was the first woman to read the news on TV in Africa. My mum's mum was a nurse and my mum's dad was a chemist. And my mum's dad actually started writing a novel, but he never finished it before he died. And my mum was always like, you should finish it. And I'm like, pressure. But I think they'd be really fascinating to just talk to you about what life was like when they were growing up and how they came into their careers and the different failures that they had and things like that. I always think they'd probably be like, laugh at me for all the woes that I think I have and all the issues that I think I have. They'd be like, life was way harder.
I love it. All right, thank you. Thank you for this conversation. Thank you for being so open and honest. We do have a closing tradition on this podcast. With everything that you've been through and knowing what you know now, would you still be doing the same thing? And what advice would you give your younger self?
I would be doing the same thing. And I think I would say, I don't want to use that language. Don't be such a wuss. Mm. I don't mean that in a like, you can't have emotions type of thing, but kind of like stand up for yourself. You're smart. Believe in yourself. You know what you're doing. Where you're going is where you're supposed to be going. So don't be so fearful. Just keep going at it.
I love it. Ori, where can people find you? Where can people find your books?
Don't find me. Find my books though. Yeah. No, I'm joking. Find my books in all good bookstores. There's actually a bookshop in, if you go to Portugal, there's a bookshop. I'm going to shout out my friend because she owns a bookshop, Alexandra. Her book is in Lisbon and it's called Salted Books and it's an English language bookshop. And they have a great slogan on their bags that says, buy books from bookshops, not a billionaire. So go to your independent bookstores and buy books.
And Ori's book is actually called The Three of Us.
Yes, it is. I should probably have mentioned that.
Should have mentioned it. I'm going to link it, The Three of Us. Okay.
And I have a website where occasionally I update what I'm reading, watching, listening to. And that's oriaawilliams.com.
Love it. And guys, to the listeners, if you've gotten to this point in the podcast, you know what to do. Let us know how you find this, man. This one has been such high energy. I'm so energized. I feel like I really know what it takes to either get into publishing or to write my own book. Not that I'm ever going to do it. Don't worry. But guys, thank you for getting to this point. Make sure to like, subscribe, comment. Let us know who you want to hear from next. This is another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Now go outside and take some action. Over and out.